Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. The topic I'm going to talk about tonight has had a kind of an abiding sort of interest for me ever since the days, going back about 7 years ago now, when I used to work as a Holocaust educator. One of the trips that I took out to Krakow, where we took a party of school kids, we would go to Krakow with the Holocaust Education Trust and then go to Auschwitz-Birkenau and come back. We always had the great benefit of having some amazing Polish guides with us, who we would go around Auschwitz one and then Birkenau with. And I struck up a conversation with one of them about post-war anti-Semitism. There were attacks on Jewish survivors in Poland after the liberation of the camps, and this guide talked to me in great depth about the long history of communist anti-Semitism, which is something that really is hugely underexplored. I've had for many years a book by Jeffrey Herf called Divided Memory, which looks at the memory of Nazism in both East and West Germany during the Cold War. And of course, you know, the key aspect of the fundamental core of the remembrance of Nazism is the remembrance of the Holocaust. And the way in which the Holocaust is remembered in both states is very complex, and in many ways the lingering anti-Semitism happens in the East. There's plenty of it buried in the West, but the East, for its own reasons, has a very toxic relationship and a very complex relationship with its history, with the past of the Nazi regime. But anyway, we're going to look at Jeffrey Herf's book tonight, And he writes, by 1948, the wartime alliance had collapsed and been replaced by the new and reversed fronts of the Cold War. In both East and West, present politics was projected back into the past, with the result that wartime solidarities became at best a political embarrassment and at worst grounds for suspicion of disloyalty. In the Soviet bloc, the anti-fascist allies of 1941-45 once again became Western imperialists. Stalin's own wartime Western alliance was now an embarrassing and fleeting chapter, at best a cynical act of convenience, and at worst a source of subversive ideas about democracy and human freedom. Those communists who had spent war years in Western emigration fell under a cloud of suspicion. The German communists returning from Stalin's wartime Moscow had little difficulty mobilising their version of wartime anti-fascism in the service of the Cold War. Those returning from the West, Jews, or simply those who could not or would not make such a dramatic and sudden shift of allegiance and memory, were in an especially precarious position. The marginalisation of the Jewish catastrophe was inseparable from the forgetting of the Soviet Union's wartime alliance with the West. So what we have here is the need to kind of mentally erase large parts of the history of the Second World War. Of course, the Second World War as experienced by Jews is not the Second World War that's experienced by Russians or British or Americans. There's a really interesting bit in Thinking the 20th Century by Tony Judd and Timothy Snyder, where he made the point that Jewish survivors of the Holocaust that emigrated to Britain when their children were growing up in the 1950s in school, hearing about how some children's dads were with Monty in the desert, their father's memories of, or parents' memories of the war were something really, really quite different, the experience of slave labour and extermination. Having to take this uniquely Jewish memory and subsume it is the first part of how we get to an unofficial war against the Jews in East Germany. Post-war communist antagonism to the West overlapped with and reinforced both older and more recent anti-Western and illiberal currents of German nationalism. The conjecture of Cold War antagonisms with older nationalist resentments reinforced the existing marginalisation of the Holocaust in official communist memory, fueled a purge of those within the communist world who supported post-war solidarity between communists and Jews, and sustained four decades of anti-Jewish policies at home and abroad. Now, the irony here is that the vast majority of Jews who survived were liberated by Soviet soldiers. There were camps like Belsen and Dachau that were liberated by the British and the Americans respectively. But for the most part, the camps in the East, places like Auschwitz-Birkenau, were liberated by the Russians. So the Soviet Union has a huge role to play in ending the Holocaust, something that one would argue any state would be justifiably proud about. However, the point it makes here is that Holocaust remembrance and the Nuremberg trials and the condemnation of Nazi crimes was intimately linked with, I guess, a new liberal Western world order based around the rule of international law and the United Nations, war crimes tribunals and all that sort of thing. It's seen as, Holocaust remembrance is seen as a Western thing, something that, you know, Western capitalist states have appropriated. Since the mid-19th century, German liberals and socialists had argued that the struggle against anti-Semitism was inseparable from the struggle for democracy. The purging of cosmopolitans, this is a code in Germany for Jews, and in the Soviet Union for Jews, and a wave of government-initiated anti-Semitism were important steps in the consolidation of the anti-fascist dictatorship in East Berlin. These were among the most grotesque ironies of German history since 1945. And the Cold War has a habit of doing this, a habit of kind of inverting our expectations and assumptions. and creating results that seem paradoxical, seem to make no sense. Jeffrey Hirth writes, in 1948-49, the crystallization of the Cold War brought with it a re-Stalinization of East Germany into what communists called a party of a new type, modelled on the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. World War II and the occupation era had blurred distinctions between communists and non-communists. In 1948, a third of the 2 million members of the SED had been social democrats. Re-Stalinization meant that at the end of any pretense that there would be parity between communists and social democrats, and brought repression of the hints of fresh air that had entered the communist parties during the period of the Popular Front and the war. It also meant the formation of the Central Party Control Commission, led by Herman Mattern. The ZPKK, as it was known, enforced the ideological conformity and uncovered ideological deviations. The SED's first party conference in January 1949, represented a high point in the Stalinization campaign. At its 16th meeting on the January the 24th, 1949, the party leadership elected a Politburo that would lead the party in the direction of Marx, Lenin and Stalin. This new leadership included veteran communists Wilhelm Pick, Franz Dahlem, Paul Merker, Walter Ulbricht, and former Social Democrats Otto Growohl, Friedrich Ebert, and Helmut Lehmann. That Friedrich Ebert, not to be mistaken with the post-war Reich President of the Weimar Republic. From 1949 to 1953, the essential instruments of Stalinist dictatorship were put in place in the German Democratic Republic. Article 6 of the East German Constitution stipulated that incitement to racial and nationalist hatred, fostering a witch hunt against democratic institutions and organisations, and opposing efforts at equality were crimes. Such vague and general formulas could be and were used to criminalise and then repress political dissenters. In December 1949, the Obergericht, the East German Supreme Court, established in 1950 alone, it convicted over 78,000 persons of political crimes and carried out 15 death sentences. On February the 8th, 1950, the Ministerium for State Security, the MFS, was established, although other parties had seats in the East German Parliament of Volkskammer. The SED, in fact, had a monopoly on power. At the SED Third Party Conference in July the 20th to 24th in East Berlin, the leadership demanded a sharpened struggle against the Tito clique, Trotskyists, and the remains of social democratism within the SED. It also called on party members to increase their revolutionary vigilance and expose and destroy bourgeois nationalist elements and all other enemies of the working class and agents of imperialism, no matter what flag they flew. In the year that followed, as a result of investigations by the central and local party commissions, 150,000 people, most of them social democrats, were expelled from the SED. The vast preponderance of communist repression was directed at non-communists. Okay, so how does this relate to the Jews? Well, the moment that you start to in sort of anti-Semitic thinking, or which had its foothold in Marxist-Leninism, the application of Marxist-Leninism, shall we say, the idea that in a kind of like a totalitarian, highly paranoid surveillance state, the idea that there were foreigners amongst the there were foreigners in one's midst.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Which Jews had been made under Nazism. They had had their citizenship stripped away. The idea of Jews being foreign to Germany, to East Germany, to being perhaps loyal to other states, is accentuated with the creation of the State of Israel. Because the accusation can be, oh, well, look, you know, you have your own country now. So the idea that a Jew born in Germany who lives through Nazism and sort of somehow survives Nazism but emerges in the in East Germany can still be considered to be foreign, to be alien. That shows you, in some ways, how successful Nazi ideology had been and how it had been kind of absorbed on a kind of a far deeper uncritical level. Yet the revolution devoured its own as well. Paul Merker was the most prominent Communist Party victim of the Stalinist apparatus, which was constructed when he was at the pinnacle of his power. Earlier on, the author has noted that Merker combined communist orthodoxy with continuing solidarity with Jewish survivors. With his shift of alliances to the Cold War, his sympathies for the Jews became a political liability, what the Germans called an ungleichzeitig, or out of place. At the Third Party Conference, he was not re-elected to his position in the Politburo. Stalin and the Stalinists of the Soviet bloc saw Ulbricht, threw overboard the excess baggage of the dissonant memories of World War II and the Holocaust as they turn their ship of state around to fight Western imperialists. So the Holocaust is, at this point, is an inconvenience. It is a bit of historical memory that doesn't really sit very well. And lots of the new Warsaw Pact countries like to downplay the Holocaust as a Jewish tragedy. What they in Poland, in Czechoslovakia, in East Germany, they tried to present the loss of Polish Jews or Czech Jews or East German Jews as a Czech, Polish or East German tragedy, that these were Polish victims of fascism. The reason for doing that is has all sorts of roots in the kind of the post-war expulsions of Germans from these countries, the idea that you're creating these kind of unitary ethno-states in a way, and playing up the tragedy of people that you are purposefully othering doesn't make much sense in that context. But also, it is part of the narrative of the great anti-fascist war that is sort of inconvenient, it's messy, it doesn't really fit very well. But the anti-cosmopolitan campaign drew on mutually reinforcing associations of Jews with the West, as well as Stalin's personal blend of paranoia and anti-Semitism. Okay, so this is probably the subject of a much later podcast, but Stalin himself launched his own anti-cosmopolitan campaign in the last few years of his life. He was preparing, before he died, an enormous purge of Russia's surviving Jews, and part of this was to do with his with the creation of the State of Israel. Stalin viewed it as a Western satellite, and therefore, in his paranoid thinking, well, these Jews, this is where they come from, and they are now, this has now fallen into the umbrella of the West. There was a moment in perhaps 1948 where the possibility of Soviet patronage was considered, and Stalin had hoped that might be a possibility. It was very, very, very fleeting. Whilst World War II had expanded contact with the West and with Jews in the West, the Cold War would now immunise the Soviet bloc from their subversive impact. So there, I mean, you know, obviously that's the author paraphrasing what it was that communist authorities were thinking. But the idea of Jews being subversive, Jews being untrustworthy, Jews being disloyal, again, it follows an anti-Semitism that seems to kind of leapfrog over ideological divisions. The campaign began with the murder of Solomon Mikhalz on January the 12th, 1948. In November 1948, the Soviet government abolished the Jewish Anti-Fascist Committee and arrested its leaders. In March 1949, an article on the uncovering of bourgeois cosmopolitanism was published in Moscow in the German language paper Neue Zeit. It described cosmopolitanism as a key element of reactionary bourgeois ideology and American imperialism. In the Middle East, Soviet policy turned from its initial support to enduring hostility for the new Jewish state. The anti-cosmopolitanism campaign had clearly been initiated as and inspired by Stalin. The East German communists, however, far from protesting against the campaign, made their own distinctive contribution to it. And we will look at that another time. This is a kind of a topic that I think can run. But I think it's important to realise that a lot of the rhetoric, a lot of the kind of the Stalinist rhetoric of anti-fascism is a nonsense, really. Stalin was more than happy for a period of time to collaborate with Hitler in the assumption that Western Europe would be crushed by Nazism, or at the very least there would be some long drawn out struggle between liberal capitalism and German fascism, which would leave Europe so devastated that the Soviet Union could sweep across it and impose Soviet states all the way to probably the English Channel. Stalin was more than willing to entertain Nazism when it suited him, and was there were discussions, none of them came to anything, between the Nazi regime and the Soviet regime about, you know, working out somewhere that the Jews could be put. It was hoped, and Stalin was too suspicious of this, that before the final solution was figured out, and before Operation Barbarossa began, during the period of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact, there was some discussion about dumping occupied Europe's Jews in Siberia, where, you know, they could be worked to death by the Soviet Union, though this never came to pass. So anti-fascism is something that happens in as much as the Soviet Union fought a war against fascism, but in a refutation of fascism's core beliefs. There is more than a little overlap. I mean, the guiding idea of Marxist-Leninism is that of class struggle as opposed to racial struggle. But Stalin was able to look at a picture of the world and say, but there, you know, there is danger and subversion, and it comes from these sorts of countries. I mean, one of his great overriding suspicions was always of the Poles, and, you know, anyone who was a Pole was evidently dangerous, even if that kind of in itself subverted whatever supposedly progressive ideas existed within communism. The idea that, you know, if you come from an ethnic group, then you are somehow suspicious. So what we see here is the continuing anti-Semitism of Nazism kind of co-opted by the necessities of the Cold War and the fact that East Germany takes its kind of direction from Stalin, but also is a key player in the new suspicious paranoid realities of the Cold War and Israel's position as a Western ally. Okay, well, I've gone for long enough. I'm going to finish there, but we'll talk about Jeffrey Herf's amazing book a little bit more later on. I hope you enjoyed this. Do check us out on YouTube and come to the Explaining History Facebook group if you can. And I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Thanks, all the best. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
So, you've got an idea for a business. The store of your dreams. There's just one thing to figure out. Everything. That's why Shopify's all-in-one commerce platform makes it easy to sell online, in person, and everywhere else. Sell on social media, source products with an app to get that first sale feeling. It's the only solution that gives you everything you need to sell everywhere you want. So when you're ready to bring your idea to life, power it up with Shopify.
Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/listen.